لشکر آمدیم.
Muslims commemorate Ashura, which marks the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam. Russian President Vladimir Putin says Moscow is ready for talks with Kiev to try to end the conflict, but Ukrainians have refused to take part. And coup leaders in Niger have dissolved the government and have declared General Abdurrahmane Tiani as head of state. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, millions of Muslims throughout Iran and other countries have been taking part in nationwide processions to mark the day when Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam, was martyred. Yusuf Misha Ahmadi has more.
People from all walks of life, young and old, clad in black, out on the streets taking part in mourning processions. During the first 10 days of the Islamic month of Muharram, culminating in Tasua and Ashura, eulogists recite the events of the Battle of Karbala, and Islamic scholars elaborate on the underlying message of Imam Hussein's stance against tyranny. Tasua is the ninth day of the lunar month of Muharram. It is considered a very important religious occasion as Muslims worldwide commemorate the martyrdom anniversary of the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Ashura, which literally means the 10th of Muharram, is the day Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in southern Iraq in 680 AD, as they fought courageously for justice against the much larger army of the Umayyad Caliph, Yazid I. Imam Hussein alayhi salam is a hero that transcends time. His goodness makes him a moral example for all human beings worldwide, and foreign students at Tehran University have not missed the chance to mourn for the much revered Imam along with the entire Iranian nation.
We all gather here, irrespective of religion. Here in our Hayat, a lot of students who belongs to the different sects like Ahl Sunnah and other sects as well, they work for the love of Imam Hussein.
The very popular phrase, Hubbul Hussein Yajma'ana, this is the actual meaning of it, that everyone from around the world, no matter of their background, can come together and commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein for one message, the message of Islam, the message of the grandfather Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Participating in Hayat means like propagating the message of Imam Hussein, which is justice and unity.
Tearful mourners take part in rituals while educating the younger generation about the sufferings of Imam Hussein. The processions continue until noon. After the prayers, people line up for lunch. Many people consider it an honor to serve the lovers of Imam Hussein, and that is why they give away food not just to the needy, but also to those that have been taking part in the processions.
Cooking for a large crowd is very difficult, but we enjoy serving the lovers of Imam Hussein. It's an honor. Today we served about 3,500 meals.
The positive vibes that we get on this day is simply incomparable to any other experience.
The mourning rituals of Tasua and Ashura are considered an important part of Iranian culture, mostly because of the opportunity to reflect on Imam Hussein's values, his way of life, and what he stood up for. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Muslims in Afghanistan have commemorated the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, grandson of the Prophet Muhammad as well, and this despite limitations imposed by the ruling Taliban and threats of terrorism. Ramatollah Baghban reports from Kabul.
people in Afghanistan have been commemorating Muharram in large gatherings under the rule of the Taliban and amid security challenges. Taswa falls on the ninth day of the Islamic month and is devoted to Imam Hussein's brother, Abul Fazl al-Abbas. To mark the occasion, thousands of mourners converged on one of Kabul's oldest shrines. Participants expressed their affection and devotion to the martyrs of Karbala and honored their sacrifices.
The school of Imam Hussein taught us the lessons of heroism and freedom. Imam and his companions sacrificed themselves in the path of religion, justice, and truth. They stood for the future of Islam and humanity.
In all our processions, we witnessed both Sunni and Shia people actively taking part. They beat on their chests, recite elegies, and distribute food shoulder to shoulder with each other. This bonding and solidarity is getting stronger year after year as more and more people learn about Imam Hussein and his revolution.
On Ashura, Afghan Muslims closed their businesses and took a day off to grieve over the tragedy of Karbala. Here at Khatam al-Nabiyyin Mosque, people from different backgrounds observed Ashura as a common Islamic heritage. They emphasized the importance of Islamic unity in the face of global arrogance and condemned the recent desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden and Denmark.
We can sum up the message in Gola Ashura in one sentence, and that is resistance against the arrogant and tyrannical ruler of the time. The Afghan people proved that they are the true followers of Imam Ali and Imam Hussein by fighting and defeating the Soviet Union, the British Empire, and the United States.
Insulting the Holy Quran in Sweden and Denmark is an act of hatred and enmity toward Islam and its high values. This heinous act was against all universal and human values, and this was an insult to the sanctities of about 2 billion Muslims in the world. We condemn this insult and want it stopped.
Muharram ceremonies in Afghanistan faced some limitations by the Taliban security forces this year. The Taliban authorities cited security reasons for the measures, but many Shia Muslims are suspicious of their motive. Ashura is the call of liberty and resistance against tyranny. The ceremonies held here show people have not forgotten the steadfastness and heroism of Imam Hussein and his companions hundreds of years after the tragedy of Karbala. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
At least 4 people have been killed in a fire in the Iraqi city of Karbala, where millions of Muslims are marking Ashura. The explosions took place near Imam Hussein's shrine. The ministry said a fire at a textile warehouse triggered an explosion of fuel tanks. Fire then spread to surrounding areas and caused shops nearby to catch fire as well. Iraq's Interior Ministry has ruled out terrorism, saying firemen have put out the fire. And now we're to the coup in Niger, where the junta warned a massacre and chaos in case any foreign military intervention to try to reinstate President Mohamed Bazoum.
Despite the measures taken by the Council for the Safeguard of the Homeland, the CNSP, to ensure rapid return to normalcy, certain former dignitaries holed up in chancelleries in collaboration with the former regime have adopted a confrontational approach with a view to extracting the failed authorities. This belligerent, dangerous, and purist attitude will only result in the massacre of the Niger population and chaos. Thus, the CNSP calls national and international opinion to bear on the consequences that will result from any foreign military intervention.
Abdurrahman Mane added the constitution's been suspended. In a televised address, General Abdurrahman Chiani declared himself new leader of Niger. He's head of the presidential guard that toppled President Bazoum on Wednesday. Chiani said the military chose to usurp power in light of the deteriorating security and poor economic situation of the country. Bazoum remains in custody and has not formally surrendered power. Coup has also been condemned by several countries and organizations, such as the United States, the United Nations, and the European Union, which has threatened to cut aid to the West African nation. Russia and China have also called for dialogue. Niger is a key ally of Western countries in West Africa, and a number of foreign troops are based there. Latest official figures show number of people living in temporary accommodations in England has hit a 25-year high. Over 100,000 households were in temporary accommodations this year, including over 131,000 children in the first quarter of 2023. This figure is up 10% from the same time last year. Critics believe the government has failed to provide enough affordable housing for low-income people.
England is facing a homelessness crisis. According to the latest official figures, the number of people living in temporary accommodation in England has hit a 25-year high. Over 104,000 households were in temporary accommodation by the end of March of this year, the highest figure since records began in 1998. The figure shows a 10% jump of homeless people in England compared to last year. 9,520 more households have been placed in temporary accommodation since 2022.
Catherine Watts.
Thank you very much, Madam Deputy Speaker. Could we have a debate in government time on a very sad record which will be broken? The highest ever number of families in homeless households in temporary accommodation in London by the end of this summer. Ever, ever, ever. The long-term impacts on health and educational attainment of our citizens is at risk. Would she agree with me that in the current climate, with the mortgage crisis, the unaffordable rents going up by 20% in some London boroughs, and very, very long queues for social homes because of the lack of money from the government to build them, we do desperately need to tackle the housing crisis in London and beyond.
Over 131,000 children are also in temporary accommodation, the highest figure on record. Almost 14,000 households were in hotels or bed and breakfast in the 3 months to March. Figures also show a sharp rise in homelessness in older people in the year to the 31st of March, with a 33.3% increase in the number of homeless households with a priority need due to old age. Experts say loss of a private tenancy is the leading cause of homelessness. Instability in the private rental market, exacerbated in the short term by rising interest rates and mortgage payment increases, has led to steep rent rises and property owners deciding to sell their properties. Campaigners say a lack of housing, exacerbated by a decision by ministers to freeze local housing allowance rates for the past 3 years, also lies at the root of the problem. The number of households being issued with no-fault evictions has also risen in the past year, with a 21% increase in those at risk of homelessness due to a no-fault eviction. The government has also frozen the local housing allowance at 2020 levels. First, the amount which people claiming household benefits who rent privately are entitled.
Let's test that, because the question he refuses to answer, he actually knows the answer to this question, is £2,900 extra. That's the cost to the average family of the Tory mortgage penalty. Now, he was warned by experts about this as long ago as autumn last year, but he either didn't get it, didn't believe it, or didn't care, because he certainly didn't do anything. And when I raised this a couple of months ago, he had the gall to stand at that dispatch box and say he was delivering for homeowners. How is an extra £2,900 a year on repayment delivering for homeowners?
Numbers have sparked calls for the government to reform renting laws faster and build more affordable housing. The UK is stuck in the middle of a cost-of-living crisis, with soaring inflation leaving people struggling to pay for essentials and meet rapidly rising rental prices. There are also fears of a UK falling into recession, which will make life that much harder for ordinary citizens.
The homelessness crisis in England comes at the heels of a mortgage crisis, which has been brewing for some time. Back in June, the Bank of England hiked interest rates by 50 basis points to 5%. The move has affected millions of homeowners, as the interest rates on many mortgages are directly linked to the central bank's base rate. Renters have seen their payments increase, as buy-to-let landlords pass on higher mortgage repayments. Estimates show interest rate hike would see 1.2 million UK households run out of savings by the end of the year because of higher mortgage repayments. Higher borrowing costs are not just affecting households with mortgages and other loans, but forcing companies to tread more carefully in their management of costs in a tougher economy. The mortgage crisis comes against the backdrop of a slowdown in the economy.
If you push interest rates too high, you may be able to bring inflation down, but you will certainly push the economy into recession, and you will cause problems with the mortgage markets.
The inflation in June stood at 7.9%, a little bit lower than 8.2% in May, but still well above the Bank of England's 2% target. But at the same time, economic output fell 0.1% in May from April. All sectors of the economy contracted, with exception of services. There are now fears of a possible recession due to the inflation and rising interest rates.
I am really worried about this. I am very, very worried about this. I think the word stagflation, stag being the recession side of growth, inflation being high price inflation, is going to be something that you and me and others will say way too many times in the next few months.
Thanks for joining us, and goodbye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The United States has confirmed that Ukraine is using Washington-supplied cluster bombs against Russian military forces, despite widespread concerns that such munitions can cause huge amounts of civilian casualties. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Russia Today has covered this story and tells us more. Governor Vyacheslav Gladkov said Ukraine has targeted a village in Russia's Belgorod region with cluster munitions. Vyacheslav Gladkov wrote on Telegram on Saturday, 22nd of July, at least three cluster munitions were employed by the Ukrainian forces during a large-scale attack on the settlement of Zhuravlevka. According to the governor, 21 artillery shells and 10 mortar rounds were also fired at the village. It was also targeted with a single kamikaze drone. Gladkov wrote smaller artillery, mortar rounds and drone attacks targeted at least a dozen other settlements in Belgorod region on the same day. He said in the village of Ilek Pinkovka, 12 households were affected by an explosion, with the facades of buildings being damaged and windows shattered. The United States announced the delivery of cluster munitions to Ukraine earlier this month, with President Joe Biden describing it as a stopgap measure that was necessary due to the shortage of regular artillery rounds among Kiev's Western backers. The controversial shells, which contain multiple bomblets that are dispersed over a wide area, have been banned in more than 120 countries. However, Ukraine and the United States are not signatories to the 2008 Convention on Cluster Munitions, the CCM. Washington admitted that it was aware of the increased risk posed by cluster munitions for the civilian population, but claimed that Kiev had pledged to deploy them responsibly and steer clear of densely populated areas. Recently, White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby confirmed that the Ukrainian military forces had begun using American-supplied cluster munitions on the battlefield. John Kirby claimed they were doing so quite effectively. Russian President Vladimir Putin noted recently that the United States itself had earlier branded the use of cluster munitions as a crime, saying this was exactly how he regarded the delivery of such weapons to Kiev by Washington. President Putin warned the Russian military has a sufficient stock of cluster munitions, which it can also put to use in a tit-for-tat response to such weapons being deployed by the Ukrainian side. Meanwhile, Crimea's governor, Sergei Aksionov, said on Saturday 22nd of July that a Ukrainian drone strike resulted in an explosion at an ammunition depot in the central part of the Crimean Peninsula. Writing on Telegram, Governor Sergei Aksionov said the detonation had taken place in the Krasnovardetsky district. He added, a decision has been made to evacuate the population within a 5-kilometer radius from the site of the emergency and place them in temporary accommodation. The governor of Crimea region stated that the authorities had also suspended rail traffic in the area in order to minimize risks, whilst expressing hope that the emergency would be dealt with quickly. The Ukrainian armed forces have confirmed the strikes, claiming that they had destroyed an oil depot and Russian military warehouses in the area. Crimea has repeatedly been targeted by Ukrainian drone strikes and missile attacks since Moscow launched its special operation against Kiev over a year ago. On Thursday, 20th of July, Aksionov said a Ukrainian unmanned aerial vehicle raid on the peninsula had killed a teenage girl and damaged several administrative buildings. Recently, a sea drone strike on the Crimean Bridge, which Russia called a Ukrainian terrorist attack, damaged one section of the roadway and claimed the lives of a married couple from Belgorod region, as well as injuring their 14-year-old teenage daughter. Kiev stopped short of claiming responsibility, but celebrated the incident, while Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky later called the bridge a legitimate military target. CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Pentagon's Inspector General has revealed that some of the Western-supplied weapons and equipment supplied to the Ukrainian military forces ended up in the hands of arms traffickers, criminals, and militants. The U.S. Department of Defense report, entitled Evaluation of the Department of Defense's Accountability of Equipment Provided to Ukraine, was cited by several American media outlets on Thursday, 20th of July. In a highly redacted section of the report, the outlets reported the Pentagon official had provided several examples of Western-supplied hardware ending up in the wrong hands. Last June, an organized crime group infiltrated a volunteer battalion and stole various weapons, including a grenade launcher and a machine gun, as well as more than 1,000 rounds of ammunition. The report stated the same month, a group of Ukrainian criminals who are posing as aid workers snatched $17,000 worth of bulletproof vests provided to Kiev by its Western allies. It also described an incident in August of last year when volunteer battalion members stole 60 rifles and almost 1,000 rounds of ammunition, presumably for sale on the black market. The report showed that American military forces had failed to monitor where much of the military equipment being sent to Kiev was ending up. It said the U.S. Office of Defense Corporation in Kiev was unable to conduct required end-use monitoring of military equipment that the United States provided to Ukraine in the fiscal year 2022. It added the inability of the Department of Defense personnel to visit areas where equipment provided to Ukraine was being used or stored significantly hampered ODC Kiev's ability to execute the monitoring. The United States has delivered multiple huge shipments of a variety of weapons and munitions to Ukraine, including Stinger and Javelin missiles, howitzers, grenade launchers, as well as 1 million rounds of small arms ammunition. The delivered items also included National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile Systems, or NASAMS, newly developed Phoenix ghost drones, and high-mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS. Russia, which strongly opposes the supply of Western weaponry to Kiev, has repeatedly pointed out the dangers of flooding Ukraine with Western weapons and munitions. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, warned in May that Western-supplied arms and munitions were being smuggled out of Ukraine and sold on the black market. Zakharova warned, terrorists and criminal groups could reach unprecedented scale due to the spreading of weapons and munitions to the wrong hands around the globe. In this regard, the Russian President Vladimir Putin blames the West for stoking the flames of war in Ukraine by sending arms and weapons to Kiev to fight a proxy war against Russia. President Vladimir Putin said the Western-supplied weapons and munitions were turning up in the wrong hands.
Food for thought. Salam and our heartfelt condolences to all on the fateful day of Ashura when Imam Hussein, peace upon him, while glancing over the army of Yazid in Karbala and seeing Umar ibn Sa'd ordering his forces to attack him, had said, "This day Allah has permitted us to engage in jihad, and He shall reward us for our martyrdom. So prepare yourself to fight against the enemies of Islam with patience and resistance. O sons of the noble and self-respected persons, be patient, for death is nothing but the bridge which you must cross after facing trials and tribulations so as to reach heavens and its joys. Which of you do not like to go from this prison of the world to the lofty palaces of paradise?"
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and how he teaches us trust and reliance upon the Almighty Allah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service, dear listeners. In today's episode, we are talking about how Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he teaches us to have trust and to rely upon the Almighty Allah.
Now, when we go to the land of Karbala and we go to the day of the 10th of Muharram in the year 61 Hijri, of course, we just see this beautiful and magnificent manifestation and this zenith and apex of trust and reliance upon the Almighty Allah. In a situation that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was facing, and of course, where you have an army of well over 1,000, well, actually, according to some narrations, well over 10,000 soldiers that are ready to kill you and they're ready to murder you. And on your side, which was Imam Hussein alayhi salam's side, there's only a few, you know, tens in the hundreds of individuals, right? This is really something that is overwhelming. And so Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he teaches us how we need to have trust in the Almighty Allah, right? Now, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he did what had to be done. He did what was right. And because he did what was right, and because he stood up for what needed to be stood up for, according to an Islamic lifestyle and according to the commandments of the Almighty Allah, this is why the forces of evil came down upon him. If Imam Hussein alayhi salam had decided to stay on the side or not say anything or isolate himself or disconnect himself from the political and social affairs which were occurring, then nobody would have had a problem with him. Nobody would have come to kill him. But if Imam Hussein had done that, then, as he says, you should say salam to Islam, because Islam will be destroyed. And so in order to save Islam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam had to stand up despite the difficulties and the challenges that would come with this stand of the Master of Martyrs.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how Imam Hussein alayhi salam teaches us to have trust and rely upon the Almighty Allah. So, we had said that, you know, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was facing these overwhelming odds. He was facing this huge army, right? And by all logical and rational means, there was no way to win this kind of a battle. But, right, why did Imam Hussein alayhi salam stay upon that path, even if the likelihood of losing a physical military battle were very high? Well, this is where the trust and the reliance upon the Almighty Allah comes into play, right? Imam Hussein alayhi salam knew that the right thing to do, the thing that the Almighty Allah wanted him to do, what Islam wanted him to do, and what Islam requests every single one of us to do, is to stand up for what is right, to defend what is right, to protect what is right, and to try our best to combat and fight and oppose evil. This is what Islam asks of every single individual. And even if we take Islam out of the picture, innately, every single human being knows that this is what needs to be done if we want to live in a, you know, utopian society, if we want the world to, you know, live in peace and tranquility. And so Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he knew that this stand must be made. So this is the first principle that he was abiding by. Now, because of abiding by this principle, if challenges come about, well, so be it. Challenges will come about. It will be difficult. It will have trials. But because the first principle, which was to abide by the commandments of the Almighty Allah and to stand up for truth and justice and to oppose evil. You know, because this was correct, then you trust and you rely upon the Almighty Allah in the second aspect, which is the trials and tribulations that come about. And so here, this is how we find that Imam Hussein alayhi salam teaches us trust and reliance upon the Almighty Allah in our own Islamic lifestyle.
Again, he looked at the horizon, the swords were waiting for him.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
Anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. Silence, fill the air.
Death is my trade.
Part 1.
14 centuries before the birth of Christ, the enemies of the Hittites were forming ranks and waiting for their rivals to arrive. They were faced with a flock of rams marching towards them. Unbeknownst to them, the rams were contaminated with a poison much more lethal than the soldiers. From the following day, soldiers began to die in groups without any fighting, making this event one of the first instances of bioterrorism recorded in history. Death is my trade. Death is an undeniable truth. Every person, no matter what their school of thought, will one day taste death. And it's a reality that will sooner or later happen to everyone. The very inevitability of death has inspired many philosophers, poets, thinkers, and writers to speak about it. However, it's not just about the essence of death. Rather, it's about the experience. It's about how taking the life of a person or people is done for power and instilling fear. Think about epidemics and wars. Death and fear are the common element in both. Turkey was one of the victims of bioterrorism. On April 17, 1993, Halil Turgut Özal died of a heart attack. The shock hit his family more than anyone. They claimed that Özal had been in perfect health and that his sudden death was suspicious. His family's legal determination resulted in his body being dug up after his burial and being taken for autopsy. The autopsy brought even more shock. A deadly toxin had been found in the body of the president. The Turkish Today wrote, "Doctors verify that the amount of DDT found in him was 10 times more than the legal prescription limit. Additionally, they found traces of cadmium, polonium, and americium in his blood. Based on the autopsy, americium and polonium, which are two radioactive elements, caused immense weakness in Özal, leading to the DDT rapidly taking effect. The toxicology tests continued, verifying traces of four kinds of toxins in his system, something that his prosecuting attorney never officially declared. However, his family never stopped trying to prove that he was indeed assassinated. He died just before he had the chance to negotiate with the Kurdish PKK militant group on the 18th of June 1988 Ozal survived an assassination attempt during the Party Congress. About 4 years after the assassination of Ozal, something else happened. This time, bioterrorism stood bare before the eyes of the world. An assassination attempt was made against Khaled Mashal, one of the leaders of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas. But it was nothing like the other attacks done through hot or cold weapons. The two Israeli Mossad agents would face the same fate. One of them was supposed to open a bottle of beverage in front of Mashal to distract him, while the other poured a toxic substance on his neck. But things didn't go as Mossad had planned. As Mashal was getting out of his vehicle to go to his office, his daughter, who was in the car, started screaming. This caused Mashal to turn around just as the agent was about to pour the poison on him, preventing him from executing the plan. Mashal then left the scene, and the agents were arrested by Jordan police officers. The rest of the Mossad agents who were in the outskirts of Oman fled to the Israeli embassy. The toxin used in this operation was derived from fentanyl and was designed to kill within a few hours of physical contact. Mashal was transferred to a hospital, and although he was under close surveillance, his state began to worsen rapidly. Hussein, the King of Jordan, stepped in and threatened that if Mashal died, the two Mossad agents would face the same fate. This resulted in Israeli officials coming forth with an antidote and medical information. The assassination attempt failed, and Mashal survived. These two examples of bioterrorism against political figures show why bioterrorism is a pervasive method in eliminating opposers. The easy transmission of illnesses and the inability to scientifically prove the assassination, along with the likelihood of the death of the target, has made bioterrorism a go-to method for subversive governments. But the history of using biological weapons for terror is not limited to individuals, and there are many examples of mass bioterrorism. In October 1940, during the Second Sino-Japanese War, Japanese germ bombs flew over Chinese cities, exploding hundreds of feet above the ground and raining contaminated fleas on the people. These fleas were contaminated with germs and viruses such as cholera, typhoid, anthrax, and the plague, and caused multiple epidemics in China. This is the summary of Japan's war against China throughout 6 years, which led to the loss of over 50,000 Chinese lives. The stressing factor in the event is that Japan's biological attack against China did not end there. Around the year 1930, during its conflict with China over Manchuria, Japan unleashed germ weapons in Unit 731 under the cover of the Water Purification Department, infecting the Chinese people. This act secured Japan's upper hand in the war. Fifty-seven years after Japan's germ attack, at 16 o'clock local time, suddenly a sweet scent filled the air in Iran's western city of Sardasht. People carried on with their lives without knowing they were inhaling mustard gas and are under germ attack by Iraq under former dictator Saddam Hussein. As a result of inhaling this gas, over 130 people, most of whom were women and children, lost their lives immediately, along with thousands of casualties that are grappling with the aftermath of a few seconds of inhaling the gas until this day. This chemical attack showed that biological warfare was moving from pathogenic agents, such as viruses and germs, to chemical pollution. Naturally, the international community quickly reacted to this toxin attack and declared it a war crime. One of these countries complicit in the attack was Germany, a country whose institutions such as Karl Kolb, Bayer, and Provisage were among the companies that sold equipments and materials for chemical weapons. After the toxic attack, some countries, paradoxically including Germany, took in the victims of these attacks for treatment. However, evidence later showed that this act was more to evaluate the effect of the chemical gases rather than providing humanitarian aid to the victims. Wars have witnessed all kinds of weapons as far back as their histories go. In the beginning, weapons were designed to destroy the enemy. But over time, as wars found different goals and objectives, new weapons were created to fulfill those purposes. The most important goal was to cause as much casualties in the enemy forces as possible, with the least amount of casualties from the home front. The weapons changed day by day. But at the same time, the global community went through changes as well. It was no longer easy to start wars. Many weapons were classified as war crimes, and their use was prohibited. Yet there were still other countries who profited off other nations struggling with their basic and fundamental needs. And which need is more fundamental than the health of a country's citizens? This very matter led some countries into establishing biological labs across the world. Labs that researched and studied the most deadly of viruses that would sometimes be sent to the outside world in a more potent and lethal form and would have many people in that country or even other parts of the world struggle with maintaining the fundamental need of health. However, many deem this to be a conspiracy theory. Although the pattern of the spread of certain diseases during the last decade would not leave room for any other conclusion. This pattern of dissemination, along with other factors, such as the number of laboratories under the supervision of the Ministry of Defense in some countries, the high degree of biological safety of the laboratories, the spread of viruses in the countries that hosted these laboratories, the resistance against international conventions and obligations, and other such cases, would all lead to the same verdict. We will first refer to the pattern of a few viruses that have broken out across the world during the past decade.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Scientists are saying extreme heat is no longer rare in the modern world and that the blistering temperatures across the globe in July are a likely sign of worsening climate change. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The news agency United Press International has covered this story and tells us more. Extreme heat and blistering temperatures across the globe in July are a likely sign of worsening climate change, according to a new analysis by World Weather Attribution. Heat waves baking the United States, Europe and Asia would be virtually impossible without climate change, which is causing extreme weather and bringing death and destruction to nations throughout the Northern Hemisphere. The report published on Tuesday, 25th of July, confirmed. Without human-induced climate change, these heat events would, however, have been extremely rare, scientists in the study conclude. In all the regions, a heat wave of the same likelihood as the one observed today would have been significantly cooler in a world without climate change. As part of a study, researchers sought to assess the extent of human-induced climate change and how it is serving to alter the likelihood and the intensity of extreme heat being felt across the world. July has been one of the hottest months on record in the United States, in Mexico, southern Europe and China, where heat waves were no longer rare, but at least 50 times more likely in the modern world, according to the report. North America, Europe and China have experienced heat waves with increasing frequency as a result of warming caused by human activities. The report concluded, adding that the extreme climate events could be expected about once every 15 years in the United States and Mexico, once every decade in southern Europe, and once every 5 years in China. Previously, such heat waves would have occurred only once in 250 years, according to the report. The report comes as a dome of heat continues to sit over the southwest United States while making its way to the country's midsection, where it will affect millions of people with dangerously hot weather in the coming days. Meanwhile, parts of Nevada, Colorado, and New Mexico tied all-time highs in July, while Phoenix, Arizona recorded its highest ever nighttime temperature, which never fell below 90 degrees Fahrenheit, according to the report. In mid-July, high temperatures exceeded 122 degrees Fahrenheit in Death Valley, California, as well as in northwest China, in Sanbao province, the report said. The unrelenting heat was being blamed for several deaths throughout the United States, while hot temperatures killed more than 200 people in Mexico, including several migrants across the U.S.-Mexico border, according to the report. In Europe, Catalonia shattered its highest ever recorded temperature in July, while many parts of Spain were also experiencing dangerous heat. A report published by Barcelona Institute for Global Health earlier this month said 61,000 people died from excessive heat in Europe last summer, as temperatures surged above average every week. Spain, Italy, Greece, Cyprus, Algeria, and China also reported numerous heat deaths, as well as a surge in heat-related hospitalizations. More than 100 million people in Italy, Spain, and in southern United States are under heat warnings or heat alerts, while demand for power surged across three continents as populations struggled to stay cool. Multiple nations continue to grapple with repeated environmental disasters fueled by the climate crisis, which have ruined crops, killed livestock, and sparked wildfires and extreme flooding, while also taking a toll on major exports to America. The report also warns of increasing environmental consequences for the planet if more action is not taken under climate crisis. Unless the world rapidly stops burning fossil fuels, these events will become even more common, and the world will experience heat waves that are even hotter and longer lasting, the report says. A heat wave like recent ones would occur every 2 to 5 years in a world that is 2 degrees Celsius warmer than the pre-industrial climate. Earlier this month, climate scientists at the University of Maine recorded the hottest day ever for the world's average temperature, which eclipsed 62 degrees twice during the long 4th of July holiday weekend. Meteorologists have warned that an El Niño event was likely to prolong extreme temperatures into the coming months, raising the potential for even more heat records. Efforts to curtail the climate crisis have gained steam around the world, with hundreds of nations accelerating carbon reduction under the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, which set tangible goals to lower global warming levels over the next decade. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. The surface ocean temperature around the Florida Keys soared to 101 degrees Fahrenheit, that is 38.4 degrees Celsius this week, in what could be a global record as ocean heat around the state reaches unprecedented extremes. A water temperature buoy located in the waters of Manatee Bay at the Everglades National Park recorded the high temperature late on Monday afternoon, U.S. government data showed. Other nearby buoys topped 100 degrees Fahrenheit, that is 38 degrees Celsius, and the upper 90s Fahrenheit, about 32 degrees Celsius. Normal water temperatures for the area this time of the year should be between 73 degrees Fahrenheit and 88 degrees Fahrenheit, that is between 23 and 31 degrees Celsius, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA. The level of heat recorded this week is about the same as a hot tub. Records for ocean surface temperature are not kept, but a 2020 study suggested that the highest temperature observed was 99.7 degrees Fahrenheit in the Persian Gulf. The extreme readings add to previous warnings over Florida's warming waters in the southeastern United States as prolonged heat continued to bake other parts of the country. The South Florida coast has been grappling with an extreme heat wave that threatens marine life and ocean ecosystems. "We didn't expect this heating to happen so early in the year and to be so extreme," Derek Manzello with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Coral Reef Watch told CNN last week. Derek Manzello added, "This appears to be unprecedented in our records." Heat waves are increasingly affecting the world's oceans, destroying kelp, seagrass and corals, and killing swathes of sea life like wildfires that take out huge areas of forest. Research in 2019 found that the number of ocean heat wave days has tripled in recent years. A 2021 heat dome likely killed more than a billion marine animals along Canada's Pacific coastline, according to experts. The growing frequency and intensity of severe weather, both on land and in ocean, is a symptom of the global human-driven climate crisis that is fueling extremes, experts have warned, with current heat waves expected to persist well through August. The United Nations World Meteorological Organization, the WMO, reported earlier this month that global sea temperatures have reached monthly record highs since May, also driven in part by an El Niño event. Sea surface temperatures worldwide have broken monthly records for heat in April, May, and June of this year, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA.